This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The United States is dealing with many issues of race relations right now. It's being said by some that they're at a low, but it's impossible to gauge that. But with expressions like Ferguson's hands up, don't shoot, and New York City's I can't breathe, it's clear that we're not living in a post-racial society. But is that even a reasonable expectation? Racism, prejudice, and white privilege are facts of life. But is that true of race itself? What is race? Is it an illusion? But is it a very powerful one? What does race mean to you? How do we deal with this new face of racism, the closeted bigot? And how do we move forward? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. This is a community conversation. We're talking about race. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at @tprsource. With us on the line this hour to talk about this topic, Stephen Eric Bronner. He's the author of over 25 books, a well-established political philosopher. His latest book is The Bigot, Why Prejudice Exists, published by Yale University Press. Also with me is Robert Sussman. He's the author of The Myth of Race, The Troubling Persistence of an Unscientific Idea, professor of anthropology at Washington University at St. Louis, and his book is published by Harvard University Press. Welcome to The Source, both of y'all.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Robert, let me start off with you. You're saying race is a myth, does not exist. Well, don't we just see it every day? We see our racial society.
And we believe that race is a biological reality, but in reality, geneticists and anthropologists have found that race is not really real. You can't really, if you go to a city like New York or a large city, in anywhere in the United States, you'll see a conglomeration of different people that look like different things. They don't look like one or two or three races.
So it is an artificial construct, something that people came up to sort of justify what?
Well, most of people actually look at color as the major feature of evolutionary sort of theory in humans. But color is only one feature that humans have, and every feature that they have differs. And people are more similar across the races than there are between races. There's more similarity between people in different countries due to their background and not due to any one racial background that humans share.
Stephen Bronner, so the United States was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, but the country's early economy was based largely on slavery, so that new idea of race helped explain why some people could be denied the rights and freedoms that others took for granted. Is this how slavery took how racism sort of rooted in America's founding?
You know, my own view is that racism is part of a broader notion of bigotry. It's very rare that someone who is a racist is not also prejudiced against another group. So, for example, it's quite true that that slaves and African Americans couldn't vote in colonial America. But it's also true that those without property and women couldn't vote either. This isn't something that's unique to America. This is, I think, true of the phenomenon as such. Bigotry emerges in what I call clusters, and I think that's why I called the book The Bigot rather than, let's say, The Racist. There have been great books written about racism and about sexism and about homophobia and about anti-Semitism, but there hasn't been a book, or at least I don't think so, that's dealt with, shall we say, the foundation for all of them, which is a form of prejudice.
And so what is a bigot, then?
A bigot is someone who, if you want to put it this way, prejudges the way a person of another group will act, or the way or the traits of another group. Without evidence. The term prejudice comes from the Latin term, which means prejudgment. And the idea, if you want to put it this way, is that the bigot uses prejudice as a way of explaining the world, a way of explaining his own situation. He uses the notion of bigotry in order to justify himself and his privileges, and he also uses it as a crutch for lazy thinking. The point is to curtail and narrow the opportunities and the possibilities of any given group.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines. Javier has called in. Let's get Javier on the air. Javier, welcome to The Source.
Thank you much. I just wanted to make the comment that often we say that we're not created equal, but actually I think what we're saying is we are all created, we all have equal rights. And what I mean is there are, for example, I'm only 5 inches tall, and I could never be a national basketball player, but somebody like Shaquille O'Neal or Charles Barkley that have this infinite talent, you know, can. By the same token, there's other folks that, like Einstein. And, you know, I always want to say that it's not that they're equal. It's that we have equal rights. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Javier, thank you for your call. So, Robert Sussman, being created equal.
Yes, well, we are all created equal. But the problem is our worldview that we're trained makes us think that people are created differently. And they think that they're created differently because of a certain characteristic. And I agree that what we're talking about is prejudice. In fact, when we started sort of prejudice in Western philosophy or Western Europe, we started at the Spanish Inquisition, and they didn't just talk about races or ethnic groups. They talked about gadflies and people who were created to do witchcraft and things like that. So a number of things come together in these characterizations of other people that we put on them because of our background, not because of their background.
Do you want to add to that?
I think Robert's point is a very good one. I'd like to make two points. One is that the idea of equality before the law is what's key here. And the liberal rule of law basically knocks out any empirical determinant. Your caller is quite right. It doesn't matter whether someone's smart or short or not smart and tall. Woman, man, black, white, all these determinants fall away. Before the law, everyone has to be treated equally. And that's the idea of equal rights. The other thing that I think is important is what Robert mentioned, which is, in a certain way, it's not about the target of bigotry. It's about the bigot.
Okay.
In other words...
And we're going to talk more about that when we get back from this quick break. Got to hit this post. We're talking about race. Is it real? Is it faked? And why is it so powerful? What grip does it have on us in our lives? The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about race and the bigot. Here in the United States, the common sense belief in white superiority has justified all sorts of actions and manifest destiny, policies like slavery, the extermination of the American Indians, the exclusion of Asian immigrants, the taking of Mexican lands, and just bringing on racial practices within the government and laws and society. We want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980. With me on the phone is Stephen Eric Bronner. He is the author of The Bigot, Why Prejudice Exists, and Robert Sussman, the author of The Myth of Race. So, Stephen, you were talking more about the bigot and who the bigot is.
You know, when one thinks of the way a bigot looks at the group that he hates, it's not that he's looking at particular individuals or the potential within that group or anything like that. He makes up the idea of the Jew or the black or even the woman. If I can give an example, I think it's a good one. There was an anti-Semitic mayor of Vienna at the turn of the century, and the great composer Arnold Schoenberg was very poor, and he applied to the city for a grant. That mayor was the head of the first anti-Semitic party in Europe. And when Schoenberg applied for the grant, the mayor's assistant said to him, "Look here." The mayor said, give him the grant. The assistant said, "How can you give him a grant? He's a Jew. We're an anti-Semitic party." To which the mayor replied, "In Vienna, I decide who's a Jew." And that's exactly the idea of the, I think that underscores the position of the bigot. It's he who decides on the qualities that he attributes to the group that he hates.
Robert Sussman, author of The Myth of Race, The Troubling Persistence of an Unscientific Idea. What's the difference between race and ethnicity?
Well, I think there's very little difference between race and ethnicity, and that's the problem. Anthropologists for many years, since 1950, had said what we should call, what we call now races, are ethnic groups. And those ethnic groups are evolved and socialized to think in certain ways. And that's why different people think in different ways and categorize people in different categories. And that's why race in the United States is very different from race in, let's say, Brazil. Different people are called different things, and they don't think of the sort of three races that white Americans think of in the United States.
So race is a constantly changing, or racism, or who is white and who is out, is a changing sort of a barrier, Stephen?
It changes all the time.
I think so. You know, it's very interesting how the descriptions of one group, the bigots' descriptions of one group, often move to another. For example, at first it was a question of blacks not sharing foxholes with white soldiers. Then it was a question of women not being allowed to do so. Then it was a question of gays not being allowed to do so. In each case, there was something intrinsic and usually sexual, especially in the latter two cases, that prevented white people from supposedly being with others in the foxhole.
And Robert?
Yeah.
So the changing barrier, changing attitudes of what is race, what is that changes, who gets to be white?
Well, what happens is, if you look back in the history of the study of racism, which is really a history that goes back quite a few years in the United States and Europe, we find that different people had different groups that were in different races. They go from three races to as many as 45 or 50 races by some people. We didn't have a very specific way of dignifying or signifying who is one race and who is another. There was a specific view of that developed in the eugenics movement, where three to five races were supposed to be the most important. And through history, that's sort of what sort of stuck in the United States and American sort of view of racism.
But we have groups of people, and they're connected through culture and through shared history and through identity. And these are important ideas that these bind, you think that bind people together. Are we saying that should not be, Robert?
No, I'll go ahead first.
Go ahead, okay. Robert.
Thanks. I think that what's important is the diversity of people is extremely important and extremely interesting. And as you go to different states in the United States, you find certain ethnic groups have particular areas that they live in, and they have their own ways of looking at things. I think that's fine, as long as we respect that. And we all know that everybody has their own way of looking at things, and we always think we're the ones that have the right way. But that makes humans very sort of self-deceptive. because we always think we have the right way and everybody else has the wrong way. Variation is good. We just have to appreciate it. It's a different way of thinking because of a different lifestyle, a different worldview, a different culture that we've been trained with.
And Stephen?
Well, I think there's a great danger when one picks a group and one simply says this is its essence, this is its core quality. Because usually every group, whether we're speaking about African Americans or Jews or women, there'll be different intellectual and cultural traditions within that group. And by sort of homogenizing them, the result is one constricts their, often one constricts their possibilities, opportunities, and abilities, and different abilities to contribute to society. It's one thing to say, for example, most Italians like Italian cooking. That's fine. But it's another thing to say, blacks are really only good at sports, because that circumscribes their opportunities. Liking Italian food doesn't mean you won't necessarily like other foods.
Right, but when you say that, there's so much packed into that phrase, Italians like Italian food, because, well, it's Italian food and they identify with it, or there's sorts of generations of culture and history and memories. It's not like they have a genetic disposition towards Italian food. It's like it's a beautiful food and they own it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the issue, if this were made into a genetic claim, then obviously they wouldn't like anything else because they wouldn't have the proper gene. It's also possible that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's right. One of the real problems is that people who are prejudiced often put particular characteristics on groups of people, and it's those behavioral characteristics that do not match with any racial group that we've ever talked about. And that's the really problem with the myth of race. We're actually putting a behavioral characteristic, a characteristic of how they do things, on a group of people. And that doesn't work. It never works. It doesn't even work with medicine, as people talk about racial medicine. That's up to the individual, not up to the group.
Right, on examination, that quickly falls apart. But this is an idea that does not stand examination. It doesn't stand reason. And so, Stephen.
Well, I was going to say that the attribution of certain characteristics, there's a more radical element of this. One of the things that, for example, the racist tends to do is to project his own qualities onto those of the target of his prejudice. So, for example, in Birth of a Nation, which is the great classic film about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, what you see in the film is this obsession of whites with the sexual lust of blacks for white women. But in fact, of course, during that period of American history, it wasn't blacks who were going around raping white women. It was whites who were going around raping black women. Similarly, this occurs with the kind of anti-Semitism that existed in the 1920s. Jews were accused of assassinations, of conspiring in small groups, of manipulating the media, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what the anti-Semites were doing in Germany.
Okay, I'm going to get a caller in. Jason has called in. Jason, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. Let me see if I can compose myself correctly here. I guess whenever I think of race, I don't think of disposition in terms of personality or athletic ability or intellect. I think of it more on a biological scale. I guess the way that some people are more predisposed to having sickle cell anemia as opposed to some people are more predisposed to getting, say, certain skin cancers.
Okay. All right, Jason, good question. So, Robert, you want to address that?
Sure. It's true that certain people in certain areas, like the areas where malaria is very common, have sickle cell anemia. So there's a correlation between that area and that particular disease. But those people aren't black or white or anything like that. People in Madagascar have sickle cell anemia, and they have immunity to certain types of malaria. It really depends on where malaria is found that you'll have those kinds of genes that are related to those blood groups that actually make people less susceptible to malaria. So it's not the actual category that fits a race. It's the category that fits a particular area that has particular diseases. And that's true of almost all of the diseases that you talk about. There isn't one disease that fits blacks or whites or different people. It fits particular areas that have particular diseases.
So this goes to genetic variation. Some people are lactose intolerant. Some people are not. So is that enough to justify, not giving people equal access to opportunity and justice, Robert?
No, well, that means that those people who are susceptible to that disease are treated in that way, and those people that aren't are not treated that way. But again, if you go across those particular groups, you'll find they're not directly correlated with any particular race that we talk about. They may be more strongly correlated with a particular group because of that particular group's area in which they live, but they're not directly related to that particular group's race.
So we get back to the basic foundation that race has no genetic basis. Not one characteristic trait or even gene distinguishes all members of one so-called race from all other members of another so-called race. We're talking about race right now on The Source. We're going to take a break for NPR News, but we're going to be right back. We'll take your phone calls, and the number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies, and we are talking about race. How would you define race? What does it mean to you? We're talking about the books, The Myth of Race, The Troubling Persistence of an Unscientific Idea with the author Robert Sussman, and also the book The Bigot, Why Prejudice Persists by Stephen Eric Bonner. And we invite your phone calls as we have this important conversation. Where do your ideas from race come from? What is the source of your information about this? What is the social view of race? The number is 210-614-8980. And let's go ahead and go straight to the calls. And let's get Melissa on the line. Melissa, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for you. I happen to be a college professor, and I actually teach in this area. And my question that I constantly get from my students, and I'd like to ask you, is because race is socially constructed, will we ever get to a point where we can say that we're simply American, we're not different races, because technically we're not, we're simply American, and get to a point where it's equality that matters and not all the other stuff that we focus on?
Okay, so you're saying, can we ever get to this post-racial society where it doesn't even really matter?
And what will it take to get there, I guess?
And what will it take to get there? Okay, because your line's a little weak, so I just wanted to rephrase that. Okay. Melissa, thank you for your call. So let's go with Stephen. How do we get there?
Well, I think the ideal of abolishing racism and prejudice is very important. Whether we get there or not is another matter. I think there are too many elements of racism, wounds that haven't healed, habits that still haven't been dealt with, stereotypes that still haven't been exploded. And we can go, and they're religious, and they're social, and they're political expressions of racism that exist. However, I think what we can do, it's not an all or nothing proposition. I think our task today is to begin to marginalize racists and marginalize them ever more surely. And I think that progress has been made in that regard. Indeed, I think that the bigot has tended to change his tactics and adapt to a liberal society in the following way. Today we have a situation in which constraining voting, which primarily affects poor black voters, that's justified by fairness and the desire to eliminate fraud, which doesn't exist. Gay marriage is attacked in the name of tradition, and we can go on like this. The point is that policies are being formulated that directly target traditional groups that have suffered prejudice, but now different justifications are employed. I don't want to say that traditional Neanderthal racism has simply been abolished. Obviously, it hasn't. But I think we have to look at the new forms of racism, which involve policies. You know, it's one thing for reasonable people to disagree over this or that policy for this or that group. But it's another matter entirely when you see a person or a movement or a party endorse an agenda which disadvantages all the traditional targets of prejudice, and then disclaim that at the same time.
Okay, so Robert Sussman, tell me, how can we move forward? Can we get to a place eventually in society where a race has no bearing in the fact that if one person has opportunity or access to justice and another person doesn't?
Well, first of all, I agree with Stephen. I think we've made great progress. If we look back in the 1920s, 1930s, and when we had eugenics in America, the majority of people were prejudiced, and our policies were prejudiced. And segregation was really the main policy of America. And as we move through the 40s and the 50s, it's changed, and we have a black president now. So I think what we have to do, as is what Stephen said, move more towards a equal society, make sure our policies and our public people are not racist and are not bigots, and that they actually propose the right policies so that everybody is treated equally, and then we can have a majority of people that are not prejudiced, and then that small minority won't make such a big difference in our society. I think this has to happen in things like the police force and in our politics. We have to have more people who don't sort of carry on prejudice policies.
But, Stephen, as long as we have people who will benefit from perpetuating prejudice and bigotry, then we will have it?
Yeah, I think that really is the case. Securing privilege is an essential element of prejudice. There must be a reason why the only group that in the majority voted for Mitt Romney was white men. President Obama had support from every other group.
Mitt Romney had more white support than any other previous presidential candidate.
Indeed. And I think there was the feeling this not only that this is a black president, but that this black president incarnates precisely what the bigot most hates, his cosmopolitanism, his intellect, and, if you like, his reasonableness, and the idea that the old America is changing. There's in my book, I quote the line from a white supremacist band, which goes like this: "Whatever happened to our America, which once was white and free?" And I think that says it.
Right, and that goes to the ideal community, the imagined nostalgia that we once had, falseness of what the America was, which never really existed, but now we are on the decline because of write in whatever racial group that you don't particularly like that day.
I think all the I think all your viewers know old TV shows like Father Knows Best or Leave It to Beaver or Happy Days and the like. Each of these show for each of these shows, women were in the kitchen, gays were in the closet, and blacks, if they existed at all, were doing menial tasks. But that's not enough. That's not all. These groups liked that. And so when, from the standpoint of the bigot, the only reason they are revolting is because small minorities within each of these groups.
Right. So let me ask Robert about that. So, Robert, do you think that the myth of race persists because there is this imagined utopia of if we can have racial purity?
Well, in fact, if you look at my book, I trace racism back to the Spanish Inquisition, and it was the people in power that were trying to keep the people who were not in power from getting into power that made them prejudiced. And I think this has happened throughout all of our past history, and I think it's happening again today. And I think today, actually, what's really interesting is that we're not in a post-racial world, but we're getting closer to that world. And as we get closer to that world, those people who react against it are very much in favor of prejudice and the kinds of laws that we have today. And it just takes a little bit of time that we have to get a smaller majority to actually cover what we have in our sort of legal and political practices. In most cases, our elections are caused by very few swing voters. And people like Stephen and I have to continue to teach to get more people in that other vein that they understand what prejudice is and how it affects our policies and our practices.
Right. So, Robert, you're saying that race is really a mechanism to maintain a status quo.
That's right. That's right. And usually the status quo of those who have the power so that they can keep the power.
And, Stephen, you're good with that?
I'm very good with that. The issue, I think, comes down to this. From the standpoint in attacking the bigot, it's always been the same issue in a certain way. Whatever granted this particular group its privileges, other than the fact that the person was born that way. In other words, because you're white, you receive the privilege.
Right.
There's nothing much more involved.
And we see that even today. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're going to get to all these phone calls. Callers, stay on the line. We'll take you right after this quick break. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies talking about race and how it doesn't really exist, but racism continues to exist. It is real. With me, Stephen Eric Bronner, the author of over 25 books, a very well-established political philosopher. His latest book is The Bigot, Why Prejudice Exists. And Robert Sussman, he is a professor of anthropology, and he's the author of The Myth of Race, The Troubling Persistence of an Unscientific Idea. Lots of calls. Kevin has called in. Kevin, welcome to The Source. You're on the
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you.
Okay.
I got two questions. My question is, do you believe that inherently everyone on the face of this earth, no matter what their background is inherently racist and prejudiced to a certain extent, and that if they were to come to terms with it, no matter their degree of prejudice or racism, and that they would acknowledge it and come to face it in a constructive way instead of shunning the group that they have the prejudice against, and instead reaching out and getting to know it and fix it, would that in turn solve the problem? And my second question is, once racism, because that's the biggest prejudice issue, is fixed, there's I believe there is going to be another one that takes its place, another sort of ism. Do you believe that also?
Like classism?
Okay,
Kevin, thank you for your call. So, yeah, so let's talk about that. Stephen, everyone is prejudiced to some degree. Do you be able to look at an individual when you get on the elevator and you size them up according to how they're dressed, how they hold care of themselves, and the color of their skin, and you know, is that just human nature?
I found that human nature can be whatever any given person wants it to be. So I wouldn't perceive that way. I think the real question is why ideologies of prejudice are more appealing to some groups and some movements than other groups and other movements. I think that part of the what makes bigotry so difficult to deal with is that the bigot privileges his own personal intuitions and emotions and experiences over reasoned discourse and critique. When I wrote the book, I said explicitly, I'm not writing this in order to convert bigots because I don't think they're going to read the book in the first place. That's the problem. The bigot is going to be happy in his provincial outlook, in his dogmatism, and in his own kind of own brand of elitism.
Because he takes refuge in that.
Exactly. Exactly. This is a form of protection for him. It's as if he turns himself into stone. He's unwilling to change.
Well, some people say that's why we're seeing this resurgence of this new racism in America, because there's a privileged class in the nation that's seeing their privileges being weathered away.
Yeah, there's, I think, some truth to that. I mean, class differences, if you like, are not in and of themselves racial or sexual differences. There's patriarchy, there's institutional racism, and the like. But what is true is, let's put it on the table, the new working class, or the working class today, is primarily composed of people of color, immigrants, women, and so in a certain way, the distinction we make, or the dichotomy we make between identity and class, I think is false. I think class deals with the way in which society produces and reproduces itself.
Well, yes, let me ask Robert about that. So, Robert, classism is an even more repugnant idea in American society than racism, because we were formed, you know, the nation was founded on the rejection of that idea that everyone can grow up to be president. But yet we have, you look at the demographics today, and, you know, people are more calcified in their place, station in society now than they ever have been before. And that does follow along racial lines. But, you know, we're more willing to talk about race than we are willing to talk about class.
Well, I think that's true. And I think class is a very important phenomenon. And I think the two are correlated. But one of the interesting things is that we find like things like murder rates and people who are sent to prison and people who are collected for ostracizing other people are directly related to the equality of different states. So if we look at the equality of different people in different states, we have all of those things that are related to sort of bad factors in social relationships related to those different states.
Okay, another caller, Clayton. I'm just getting Clayton on the air. Clayton, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and I would like to pose a question to your guests. How are we going to become a post-racial society when it seems like the majority of the narrative in the media is simply vilification of people with white skin, as if they are the only people that are capable of being racist? I think your previous caller had a lot to say. I think we're all equally bad as well as equally good. And that's something to think about. I'll listen to the comments off the air. Thanks.
All right, Clayton, really appreciate your phone call. Thanks for calling in. So, Robert, you know, are we bagging on white people here?
Well, I think it's true that probably other groups have just the same kind of racism that white people have, and we have to work on both levels, both in Hispanic and race and black and white people, and try to get them all to believe that everybody has the right to think the way they want to think as long as they don't interfere with other people. It's really important that we realize that other people are prejudiced, too. That's true.
Robert, your book, Stephen, your book, The Bigot, has been criticized for equating conservatism with bigotry.
It has. And I don't want to say that every conservative is a bigot or a racist or a sexist at all. But what I do want to say is that there's an overriding tendency historically, and not just in the United States, but across the board. It's true in Europe, and it's true in Latin America, it's true elsewhere, that conservative movements or movements on the right part of the spectrum, right-wing part of the spectrum, are more inclined to embrace ideologies of racism than those on the left. I think that's true. I think this goes back to the original reaction to the European Enlightenment. That was called the Counter-Enlightenment. And this was fundamentally in which racism, anti-Semitism, narrow views on religion and the family and women were connected with anti-democratic movements. I think that only makes sense. If you're going to racism, sexism, anti-Semitism are all ideologies of exclusion. And this obviously fits with the real interests of a movement that is anti-democratic, that doesn't want to expand participation, expand the public sphere, and equalize privileges.
Okay, another caller, Armando. Armando, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to express that in my own life, I've kind of gotten away from using racism or race and adopted instead of that using the word ethnocentrism or, you know, ethnicity and talking about, because people in our society and the variety of cultures and histories and experiences, because it helps me deconstruct who they are and not base it on someone's just their skin color. And, you know, it helps also get me centered to understand, you know, this issue of power and control in our society, you know, and the equity issues that we face every day. So getting back to the previous caller, there is an impact when someone from a dominant control group, from a power group, is able to then say something or insult another culture that's less dominant and has less control, because the impact is different. And I think that's very important to understand.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to express that, and I thank you.
All right. Thank you, Armando, for your call. Stephen, you wanted to address that?
Yeah, I think Armando's exactly right. If one drops the power relation out of prejudice between the bigot and the target of his bigotry, then one's left with a meaningless discussion. The point is not, the aim is to equalize the power of each in our society, but to believe that power is already equalized, I think is really naive.
Okay, it's back to the power, it's back to the status quo and being able to, but the idea of that there are people who are inherently inferior in our society, I think most people don't even believe that anymore. Even the biggest that we see today, that it's gotten more subtle than that, Stephen.
Yes, that's what I tried to argue in my book, and that's why I think, and I think Robert would probably agree with me, that in a certain way...
We're almost out of time, so Robert, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do, uh-huh.
All right, well, that's progress.
There you go. And it seems to me what we have to center on is the policies.
Policies.
Not the motivations and beliefs of the
people. And making sure everyone has equal access to law, justice, and opportunity.
Exactly.
Thank both of you guys, Stephen Eric Bronner and Robert Sussman. Thank you all so much. This is The Source on KSTX.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is produced by Paul Flav and David Martin Davies. Our engineer is Doug DeMore. Management and oversight provided by VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Production assistance is provided by me, Ruben Garcia. The Source is a production of Texas Public Radio. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.